Grazier, photographer, keeper of history, and visionary behind the Sturt Steps project. Ruth Sando is one of the main movers behind tourism in far west New South Wales. From the moment she first saw what is now the Milperinka Historical Precinct 45 years ago, she saw its historical significance and tourism potential. Sitting under a bird-filled tree on her family's property at Pimpara Lake, northwest of Packsaddle, she shares the story of how her family came to be in this part of the world.
So shortly before we were married in 1977, John's father died, and his family had country in South Australia between Peterborough and Oraru. And then as a consequence of his father dying, the property was sold, and John inherited a portion of the proceeds. And so we decided that we would like to buy a property in our own right and set ourselves up. But by the time that happened, we had a 3-month-old baby. And basically land in Western New South Wales was historically cheaper than land in South Australia. And so we started looking around this part of New South Wales and eventually ended up here at Pimpara Lake.
And tell me a bit about the property. What do you run here?
So it's an interesting landscape for a start. It's a sandy loam environment with a range of different grasses and trees, such as we're sitting outside here amongst some box trees alongside the lake. But there's mulga country and balar and big trees like that, and then quite a lot of shrub species, so the dodonias and some eremophilas and those sorts of things, as well as a lot of native grasses and blue bushes and forbs. So it was grazing country, and we historically had some merino sheep which we brought up with us, and that was the start. So that was early in 1980, and of course in those days interest rates were fairly challenging. They were sitting at around, I think when we borrowed money to buy this property, but had to borrow quite a bit, we our first loan was at 9%, and within just a very short period of time it was reaching up, you know, 17%, 16%, 17%, 18%.
Wow.
And it turned dry very quickly. We ran into the 1980s drought, so that in itself was a real challenge. So we had to deal with it the best way we could. And John has a real interest in earth moving machinery, and so he started getting small contracts off farm, off property, and that gradually built into, over a period of years, built that into quite a substantial business. And so that off farm income really was the thing that helped us survive. But of course, in the meantime, two daughters were born. So there were lots of things that John missed out on, really. Birthdays and school functions and a whole lot of activity like that, that he really sacrificed himself so that we could ultimately achieve what we wanted to do here. And of course it rained eventually, and we were delighted because we realised how brilliant this country is. Once you add water, it just responds so quickly, and bit by bit we were able to get going, if you like. The other thing that was on the property had in deficiency were watering points, and I read a document the other day. It said we had 4 dams when we came. Well, we've now got nearly 20.
Wow.
So, you know, John's, again, his ambition to put in watering points so that you can more evenly graze the land. You're not putting so much pressure on certain parts. Flogging it out is the term that you often hear, flogging the country. And we endeavoured to spread the livestock right across the place so that it evened off that grazing pressure.
You're touching on something there that I think people who haven't spent a lot of time in rural and remote areas might not realise about farmers and their relationship with the land, which is that it's so much of it isn't just about getting getting crops or livestock out of it and making a profit. It's about really managing and, yeah, and looking after that country.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we've always felt that we had a responsibility to the land. We could see what it was capable of doing, of being more than doing, I suppose. And we also could see areas that had been degraded by overgrazing. And it actually created, in a sense, it creates that overgrazing thing when it creates a really false sense of what the land is about. So if the native grasses are removed and the native salt bushes and edible shrubs are removed, then it enables what we call them woody weeds, but the Dodonias and some of the Eremophilus acacias outcompete native grasses. And so it actually helps. It creates forest, which in terms of carbon these days and carbon sequestration, putting it back down into the soil, is probably a good thing. But on the other hand, it creates almost a desert-like environment because the grasses are gone. All that understory stuff is gone. And so it's a real challenge to try and bring that whole balance back into the property.
Prioritise needs.
Yeah. Mm. And I mean, the other thing is too that if you're trying to grow animals, wool, so much energy goes into growing wool and into growing the sheep, and they have to be a certain distance from a watering point, so they're not walking out too far to get a feed and then come back. So it's about the property, but it's also about ensuring that the livestock have adequate nutrition to do what we need them to do, and that is to grow, produce meat, produce wool, and so on. So it is about balance, and it's been about a lot of hard work to actually put all those things in place that enable us to you know, keep going on the property that we really do love. Yeah.
You just talked a lot about what you love about this place, but what would you say is, I guess, a highlight? What do you love most about?
Rain.
Rain when
I love it when it rains. You spend a very long time, you know, looking at the sky.
Longingly.
Yep. So, yeah, so the droughts, I guess, have been the real challenges. And, you know, you just sit and wait. We de-stock, we take livestock off, so that we absolutely reduce that pressure even more. But it's, the rain. I guess
seeing the country come to life,
and absolutely. I mean, I couldn't believe the first time, because it was a real period of despair, I suppose. You know, what the hell have we done? Why have we come here? How the heck are we going to get out of this? And then it rained, and within 24 hours you've got little minuscule green plants poking up through the soil, and then you go back the next day and they're a quarter of an inch, and so on and so on. And so you develop that understanding that it will come good, but the time it takes between the last rain and the next rain sometimes can test that faith in the landscape.
What do you think is the hardest thing about living out here?
Look, I don't find anything now, apart from the seasons, I don't find living here hard at all. If you asked me that question 40 years ago, I could have rattled off a whole list of things. I mean, we had generator power at that time. So the 240 volt power was intermittent because it was used when we needed to use an appliance or run the freezer, or I needed to do the washing, or I needed to vacuum, or whatever. So that was intermittent, but at the same time as it was doing those jobs, it was actually charging a bank of 32 volt batteries, so that at night, if the generator wasn't going, we had these glow-in-the-dark sticks. They weren't much better. So that you could actually see your way around. The real challenge came in the summertime, because it can get fairly cozy out here, as we all know. And we didn't have the generator going, and we didn't have air conditioning really. But we inherited this 32-volt portable water cooler arrangement. And we'd line all our beds up on the front veranda where it's gauzed in, and the breezes, if they were there, would come in. But we'd have this 32-volt cooler thing going ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and every now and again a bit of sort of coolish
cool
air
breeze would come through.
But, you know, we'd sleep under wet sheets or wet towels, or somehow or other we woke up the next day and got on with it. So those were challenging times. The other things was the communication, a telephone. We had one, but again, it was intermittent. There are many, many stories I could tell about telecom coming and fixing whatever was the problem, and then they'd drive off up to the airstrip, because I used to fly in to fix it, and no sooner had they taken off, I'd be back to square one again. So there were those challenges. For a short period in those early days, as a woman in a relatively male-dominated environment, that it could be a bit lonely. I don't have any sisters, and my mother was a long way away, and I really didn't know any women here in the bush at all. We had a HF radio, and I'd turn it on, and on channel 2020 used to be called the Galah session, and you'd hear all these women chattering away, you know, a bit like the budgies we can hear now, but talking amongst themselves, and just that whole engagement, I suppose, at a woman's level. And I used to feel, oh, one day maybe I'll know these women and I'll be able to be a part of that conversation as well. So they were interesting times, I think. And healthcare, I mean, as you know, we're part of the Flying Doctor Service network. And of course, with small children, there are often instances where you need to speak to a doctor. And I was always very shy about using the radio to communicate. But two times a day, when they used to have, the RFDS would have call-in sessions, so 8:30 in the morning and 4:30 or something like that in the evening, you could call in with your medical problems. Of course, you know, everyone else in the district could listen in as well.
No privacy for your doctor's session.
There was no privacy for a doctor's session. But anyway, we got through that. But
so you got to know each other intimately and all your health problems.
You knew. And I can distinctly remember one occasion, our daughter Elizabeth was only probably 12 weeks or something like that. She'd been a preemie baby, and I wasn't able to bring her home until she weighed 6 pounds. And so we eventually got her home, and she was just blossoming. One morning, John and a neighbour who used to come and help with some mustering had gone off mustering. And I went to change Elizabeth's nappy, and I could see blood in this nappy, and I thought, this is not good. So I contacted the Flying Doctor Service, and we had various conversations, mostly over the phone, thank goodness. That must have been working that day. But the arrangement was that they would fly in from Tibberborough on their way back to Broken Hill and pick me up. Anyway, so John was away, and I had no way of contacting him.
Yeah.
He didn't know. So we had a toddler as well. David was 2.5 or thereabouts. And the Flying Doctor people came, and we went up to the airstrip, and we're about to get into the plane and fly off to God knows where. And John came along on his motorbike. I couldn't believe it. You know,
wow.
It was just absolutely perfect timing, because I would hate, even now I think about it, would have been horrible for him to go home and find this dear John, baby's crook.
Don't panic, we've gone with the Flying Doctors. Yeah.
But anyway, as it turned out, we did fly to Broken Hill. But then they flew us on to Adelaide, luckily she was fine. We were down there for a few days and she was fine. You know, those sorts of little things, you sort of look back now, it's all a long distant memory, but at the time they were, for us personally, they were really big issues. Anyway, we got through them.
The scale of the challenge and the risk of living out here kind of makes those communities tighter. Services like the Flying Doctors or the School of the Air, all those kinds of things. You're really extra appreciative of those kinds of organisations.
Absolutely. I mean, I've certainly, I've had a long time now with the as a board member of the Flying Doctor Service, and part of that is because of some other health issues that I encountered a bit later on. But it is so vital that those services are maintained in the bush. And it's really important for people who are travelling through the area also to understand how important it is, because you never know when, you know, a kangaroo is going to jump out in front of the car and you'll have an incident, or you know, you might cut your foot at a campground, or you know, a health issue crop up somewhere else. The RFDS is there to support people in those circumstances. It is largely underfunded because it's a very complicated funding arrangement, but without charitable support and fundraising, it really could not deliver the primary health care and emergency care to the extent that it does today. And particularly after the drought, or during the drought and COVID, when there was a real emphasis on mental health issues, alcohol and other drugs, those parts of health in the bush, we couldn't do it without the Royal Flying Doctor Service. So I'm really very proud to have been able to be part of the organisation that provides that service. School of the Air, the same thing. Our children actually ended up doing more correspondence, straight correspondence from Adelaide. There's a whole range of reasons for that, but I know from the experience of the young mothers in the area today and their children, that School of the Air provides a huge social network for them. It makes lifelong friendships, and not just between the adults, but obviously the children as well. Mm. So yeah, those two organisations and entities are really absolutely vital to life and the quality of life in the bush.
Now, you mentioned you, for a long time, worked with the Flying Doctors on the board.
I still am.
And you still are, right? Mm-hmm. You're involved in a lot of different community organisations and projects. I think everyone knows you in this region for the work that you do. And one of those roles has been to see this Sturt Steps project come into fruition.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to be involved with that, and where did all this come from?
Yeah, so that's another really good question, actually. It's been a very long process. Sometime in 1980, John and I were taking the drive up the road to Tibooburra for the very first time, and we saw that magnificent building that's now been restored, the Milperinka Courthouse. And it just absolutely struck me that in this environment, so far away from any major town, that a building of such, not grandeur, but stature, could have been built. So that sort of piqued my interest in how did this come about. But it was still at a time when I didn't know people really here in the bush, so, and I didn't know how things worked, and I didn't have time really either, to be honest. But fast forward just a few years, and Raylene and Ken Ogilvy were publicans at Milperinka Hotel at that time. Raylene is just one of the most outgoing people that just can rally people around her to get things done. She's a wonderful person. Anyway, she also believed that the courthouse needed some attention. And so she did rally the community, and I got involved at that stage. We were able to see some restoration work done on it, and then some additional work in 1988 for the bicentenary. And then things sort of went into abeyance for a while. Raylene and Ken bought a property just across the border in South Australia. So things sort of got quiet, and by then my children were at school and I needed to teach them. So they were all, I spent 16 years homeschooling them. I think I deserve a medal just for that.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so when our youngest daughter, Jenny, had reached high school age, I was feeling a little bit empty nested and started to look for an external challenge, I suppose. And so the Milperinka thing sort of bloomed centre of outside business then. And so it's grown from there. But we formed a little association to help understand what it was and get some direction for where we wanted to go. But really it was listening to ABC radio, and I heard an interview with a lady from State and Regional Development. I didn't even know such things existed, to be honest, but she alluded to funding that might have been available. And so it's just that learning thing that you pick up on bits and pieces of information that might be able to help you along the way. And so it started to happen, and we put some information about the district in the old courthouse and went from there. And then I had a meeting. By that time I'd sort of networked, I guess, around the district a bit more. And we had a meeting in Milperinka. We had David Croft, who was down at Fowler's Gap, the University of New South Wales. Ingrid Witter was managing Sturt National Park. Barbara Howe-Camp was a ranger, or whatever title she had at the time. So we all sitting around a table trying to create a list of all the things that set this part of the country apart from everywhere else. What are the landscapes that we have that aren't anywhere else? What are the plants that exist here? What the bird life, the history, the Aboriginal cultures, and the night skies, the wonderful, clear skies that aren't affected by ambient light and so on. And top of that list really came Sturt. You know, the one thing that linked just about every place across this whole district from Broken Hill right up through where we're sitting here at the moment to Milperinka, Tibberborough, Cameron Corner, was Charles Sturt's expedition. So I sort of filed that away in the memory and then applied for some funding to create a touring route. Didn't get the funding, and I thought, oh, blow it, I'll just do it anyway. And and so on some mapping, drew some coloured lines. And gradually, as we got a little bit of marketing out there and website and for Corner Country and Facebook page, bit by bit, that route has become known. And so about 4 years ago, I saw an advertisement for some fairly major state government funding. And I'm reading through all the words around this, and it said, minimum application, $5 million. And I'm going, oh my God, how can we ever put together a $5 million project? Anyways, just started thinking outside the box. You know, it's an infrastructure project, so we have to build things, whether it's attractions or amenity or signage, whatever. It has to be something built. And so just started thinking outside the box and contacted Laurie Mode, who had put together the Darling River Run touring route, or oversaw the project. Contacted Laurie and said, you know, what do you reckon? What can we do? And so we brainstormed a few ideas and contacted people like National Parks, West Darling Arts, University of New South Wales out at Fort Grey, Land Council in Tibberborough, all of those sorts of groups. And bit by bit, we devised a project. So it was just absolutely amazing to think that we were successful in our application. So it's a wonderful project, even if I do say so myself, because it it pulls together not just elements about Charles Sturt, but along this touring route, some of it on the off-road, on the dirt road, follows approximately where Sturt went. Now, it's not exactly where Sturt went, because we don't have a main road system that said this is where Charles Sturt went. But by creating a circular route, we've got those off-road areas through station properties, and then we also have the now sealed Silver City Highway back to Broken Hill. And so that was the start. What do we need to do with that road? Well, we need to make it safe by making sure that it's signposted at every junction where somebody could get lost. It has to be absolutely foolproofed. We need amenities, so we need to provide a sheltered, covered interpretive spaces. And we also need the capacity to be able to expand the written story into something bigger, so that as people are driving along, they can download a podcast, or they can download an app, or I don't know, that's all technical stuff and it's out of my league, really. But in Milperinka, we've been able to build a museum space around Sturt's expedition, and also around the largest landholder in this area back in the day, who was Sir Sidney Kidman. And we were creating an astronomy viewing area with interpretation in Milperinka. We've enlarged and enhanced the caravan park there. And then by chance, we were given an opportunity to acquire a gem and rock collection. And so we'll be purpose building a centre where people can look at those elements from all around Australia, not just this local area, but whole of Australia. And then in Tibooburra, we've got the new museum space there that will cover off on the camel history of this area. It covers a lot of Aboriginal cultural stuff, but also one of the parts of that I have found really, really interesting and gets me out of bed some mornings, most mornings, is about the family stories. So just snapshots of different people who have made their home in the Corner Country and been such a part of, particularly the Tibooburra, because it's Tibooburra focused, but, you know, are important, the linkages and where they connect to and how they came into the area as miners, or whatever brought them to the district and where they've ended up now. So that's been a lovely part of the project. And then we've got the sculptural works that will appear over here at Pack Saddle. And then we've got the Fort Grey project. We've built onto the Wild Deserts program out there, where they've built massive landscaped enclosures to rehabilitate bilbies and wonderful little mammals like those. And it's all fenced in cat and fox proof netting, because there's all this wire that was left over. So what do you do with, you know, 20 ton of leftover bits of wire? Well, you make sculptures out of them. So we've now got bilbies and quolls and bandicoots bigger than Ben-Hur out at Fort Grey. And that all enhances, you know, through the visitor and the explanations of Fort Grey and the Aboriginal life there and Sturt's expedition. And then national parks are involved because, as you know, there's a wonderful cairn on top of Mount Poole that Sturt's party built during the early part of 1845. And it has sustained some damage, and if not attended to, will end up rolling down the hill in an avalanche one day. So we're dealing with that. National parks obviously are managing that aspect of the project, but they're looking at stabilising that, so it's there for generations to come, as well as adding in some safety features in the walk up the climb. So, oh, you know, it just goes on and on and on, doesn't it? But,
but I'm sure that you'll keep thinking of ways to extend it beyond that, to add to it.
Look, you know, it's that thing of how long's a piece of string. There's just so many elements to this landscape, this culture, the environment, people, the stories, the history. You know, it's just the way it is.
Mm.
Just it's an amazing place to live. I'm so grateful that in my life I've had this opportunity.
Why do you want to bring all these people out here on these roads?
I think particularly in the last couple of years with the COVID thing, but also as we see more and more people wanting to travel, that this is almost like the last lost frontier in a way. And people have, oh yeah, it's out there, but what's out there? I think that this creates an opportunity for them to learn about a really significant part of our country, about our history. And to be honest, I think Sturt deserves many more accolades than what he's ever been given. I mean, he came through this country and under really difficult circumstances. And I know one person died in that expedition, but I guess, you know, that was a dire thing, really. But he was safe. He knew what to do, pushed himself up there in that Sturt Stony Desert and had some awful tragedies with horses, and they very nearly didn't make it, but they did. And I think as a consequence of that, then we see not long after, you know, that was 45, then we had Burke and Wills come through just to the east of here in 60, went one way, they didn't quite make it back again. But soon after that, you started seeing pastoral lands being opened up west of the Darling. And the challenge has been making sure that people know about it and know what they're seeing and hear about it as they drive through and experience it.
What are some of those things or places or landmarks that you want to hail for people to be looking out for when they're, I know there's a lot, what are some of those things that come to mind as they're driving along?
If we imagine that we've got this circular route and it starts and finishes in Broken Hill, it may not, it may start at any point of a circle, but let's say we've left Broken Hill. Our first shelter with interpretation will be at Yanko Glen. The Yankawinna Creek was one of the campsites, first of all, for Sturt. It was also a place where there was a rail bridge built over the Yankawinna Creek, because they built, after Broken Hill mines were operational and they needed limestone for the smelters in Broken Hill, they built a railway line from Broken Hill up to Tarrawingee. So when you cross over at Yanko, across the creek at Yankawinna, you can still see the remnants of the old railway bridge. And then, so the, you know, there's all of that. And then there was a hotel at Yanko Glen. Why was there a hotel? Because every 20 kilometres or so along these roads, you had to have somewhere where people in coaches could pull up and be refreshed, and horses could be exchanged, because you can't push them, you know, too much further than that in one day. So you've got all these little hotels. So that's the first point. Then you go up the road, because Sturt travelled up on the western side of the barrier ranges. You've got to cross over the range for a start, as Sturt did. You've got to get out onto the western side, and our shelter there is at a property called Pine View. Now, Sturt had a camp on Pine View, one of many camps on that western side, but there's significance about that area because at that junction in the expedition, Sturt was still keen to try to find a route across the desert by going to the northwest, directly to the northwest. The objective was to get basically north of the Flinders Ranges and then continue on to see what was up there. And if I can digress a little bit, the reason they came the route they did was because Edward John Eyre had basically gone up along the Flinders Ranges, had seen this range of lakes, which he thought was one big horseshoe lake, but in actual fact we know that three separate lakes, Frome, Eyre, and then Torrens out to the west. But they didn't know that then. And so Sturt was endeavouring to get past this big horseshoe lake. But they sent a couple of blokes out on horseback to see if they could get through and couldn't. So when they came back, they were camped near Pineview Station. And today the family, the Lacey family at Pineview, can offer some accommodation for travellers through there. And then you fast forward a few years and Kidman never owned Pineview Station or a couple of other properties around, much to his irritation, I suspect. But a lot of that country was Kidman country. And so part of his chain of properties that connected waterways, so you could move stock from one property to the next and never leave your home ground, was through there. So we've got quite a bit about Kidman out on that western side. And then there's a bit of a longish drive because the road follows the main road and goes up to Borderdown and then backtracks on the Sandpar Road until it comes to the Pimpara Lake Road, which is where I live. And that we've put a sign here on Pimpara Lake because at the Packsaddle Creek, because again, Sturt's expedition had to cross this creek. In actual fact, they did camp somewhere. We don't know where, but they camped somewhere along the creek here.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, I wish I knew where, but but in his journals, he talks about sand hills and salt holes and so on. And now that's exactly this sort of landscape. It's part of the Simpson-Strzelecki dune field landscape system, land systems. So we know that he crossed through here. And then the next port of call is Mount Arrowsmith. It's a range of hills to the north. We know that they travelled around to the eastern side of the hills, but again, the road goes to the west, so we'll go west. And then that road becomes the Mount Shannon Road and continues on into Milperinka. So they're the elements on that part of the road that you'll see. And then out to the west, we'll have a shelter where the road to Cameron Corner takes off from the Hawker Gate Road. Every shelter will deal with some element of Aboriginal culture, but there's more out there. The Yandarma Creek that starts to the west of the Grey Range and runs right through to Lake Calabona. I mean, at every junction, there is something that people can learn about. And it's not just a T-junction in the road or a detour in the road. It's something happened here, and this will give you an insight into that.
So for anyone listening, stop and read the signs.
Absolutely stop and read the signs. And there will be downloadable material, but the challenge will be that there's no internet in a lot of those places.
So hopefully by this stage they've pre-downloaded the things
yes,
they need to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I know that it's probably hard for you to pick favourite spots because you love all this country and you're obviously an ambassador for lots of different points in it, but do you have a place somewhere around here that you really love to go? Maybe you don't want to share your secret spots that tourists can't go to, but where would you, if you could just recommend, if someone was like, all right, where's your favourite spot? Where should we go?
So I think actually, Amy, where we're sitting now is one of my favourite spots. Mind you, we have if I could paint the picture, we're at the edge of the Pimpara Lake, the freshwater part of it. There's also a saltwater component out to the west, but this is a freshwater component and there's infill from the Packsaddle Creek comes in, and we were very lucky a few weeks ago to have sufficient rain to just to pop a bit of water in. It's very shallow, but it's a lovely spot, and as you can hear, the bird life's amazing. That all of a sudden we have hundreds and hundreds of budgies all chattering away above us. A lot of the box trees along here are hollow, so they're breeding like mad. We've had cockatiels, You get swans out there sometimes, the little wader birds. You know, it's a wonderful landscape. It's peaceful, you know. As much as you like people, there's also that time where it's really nice not to be with people, that you can just be in your head and think about things. So this is a really nice spot. There's a few spots further along the Pack Saddle Creek that are really interesting in as much as the over, you know, however many millions of years, this broad flat creek has carved its way through the sandhills. So you get it flattened on one side, but on the other side are steep sand cliffs, and then all the birds have come along and burrowed their little, put little burrows in. And at that point there is when I really think about Sturt, because in their journals, and he talks about the wagons getting bogged, they had to abandon wagons out there. I think they lost a bullock, got bogged, and they couldn't get him out. But that's a point where I really think about Sturt and crossing this country. Actually, when I was teaching the kids, I used to make them come on, we're going to go exploring, and we'd pretend to be explorers following creek systems. And they're the natural places, but it's the man-made assets that John's put in place, the big dams. There's nothing more thrilling than driving over the top, the bank of a dam and seeing it absolutely full. It's just the most wonderful, wonderful sight. So that's, you know, that's lovely. I enjoy that.
For people visiting Milperinka, what's a highlight there for you?
I think the sheer shock of people coming into that town, particularly if they'd been there in the 80s or 90s and there was really not much there, to come in now and see what we've been able to create, it's really a bit of that thing of creating a silk purse out of a sow's ear, because although the buildings are wonderful, but we've been able to build on all of that and just create that whole learning thing. And I just love to see people come in and then go, oh my God, you know, we've learned so much here. So we have this program called a visiting volunteer program, and they're mostly people, these are couples who have literally put their hand up to come out to Milperinka on a rotational rostered basis. Some of them have come back year after year after year, and every year we also have some new people coming along. And they just put in 2 weeks there. They look after we call it a precinct, keep it clean and tidy. They meet and greet people who visit and tell stories, and are mostly very well conversed with the local history and what it's all about. And we have a little two-room cottage where they can stay, or they may choose to live in their own caravan. If it's entirely up to them. So if we go back to people who come in and feel there's nothing there, I feel really sad for the volunteers who've sometimes driven 1,500 kilometres at their own expense to spend time there. And I also get a little bit frustrated. We charge $5 for people to go through the whole precinct. So by the time this project is finished, there will be 16 different locations, all interpreted in different themes. And I don't think $5, which is less than the beer at the pub, or the coffee or the latte or whatever you want, is too much to ask people to contribute. And it is really important that they do, because once the funding has finished for this Sturt Steps project, the ongoing maintenance of all those shelters, the website that will be created, the QR codes and upgrades and all of that will fall back to our little volunteer association. And if we don't have the resources put aside to look after that for future generations, then in a way the project's got only a short life.
What does make a good tourist? What do you want people to be thinking about when they're driving out here?
I think I want them to be interested and open to learning about where they are and thinking about how this came about. How did people live here? Why did they come here in the first place? What brought them here? And then, you know, we're creating this environment, if you like, or this infrastructure that will help answer those questions. But they're the people that I think appreciate what we've done in Milparenka. They appreciate what is going on in Tibooburra and Fort Grey and all the other localities around where we've put stuff. They will appreciate that. And they're the people that I really warm to, if you like, and we'll sit and chatter away for as long as I can afford the time. But, you know, I think that's lovely. And then, you know, occasionally, for example, just recently I was in Milparenka and a lady came along and she said, "Are you Ruth Sando?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And whatever. She said, "Oh, I've read about you or I've heard about you or something or other." Oh, yeah, okay. And so even though everything was closed and dirty and dusty, because it's like that in the summer, we went for a walk and then I left them to it, she and her husband. And afterwards, as she was leaving the town, she said, "I've left something in your donation box." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." Anyway, it was quite a generous donation and it was left there because she was a person who recognised the value of what we're doing and the importance of it and the need for it to continue. But, you know, not everyone has the resources to contribute in any seriously meaningful way. But if I think they've walked out of there, they've written a nice little comment, "Gee, thanks, you know, this is terrific, thank you very much, we've learned so much," that tells me that we've gotten through, we've cut through, and people will then go on and they'll tell their friends. And the other thing that this is about is that we have very small communities with relatively small enterprises, the hotels, stores in Tibooburra, the roadhouse at Pack Saddle, the hotel in Milparenka, they are all small businesses. Being prepared to spend a little bit doesn't have to be a huge amount of money, but if everyone spends a bit, then that just helps that those businesses be sustained. It helps employment. They need people to serve. They need people to cook meals. It just helps to keep that population in the district. And Milparenka and Tibooburra will be here in another 50 years or another 100 years' time. It's like the courthouse. You know, if we hark back to the beginning of this conversation, if we left the courthouse the way it was and we didn't look after it and we didn't maintain it, I'll bet my boots that at this point in time that would be a pile of sandstone sitting on the ground in Milparenka gathering more and more dust. And we can't afford to do that.
Thanks to Ruth Sando for her time and hospitality. I'm Amy Volkowski. This episode of Meet the Locals was produced by Bushwitch Productions in collaboration with Jason King Media for the Sturt Steps touring experience. Sturt Steps is a touring route that covers over 1,100 kilometres in Corner Country, outback New South Wales. This project is funded by the New South Wales Government and administered by the Milparenka Heritage and Tourism Association Incorporated. For more information, head to the website at www.sturtsteps.com.au.